quota, this performance average, serves as the barometer against which each individual's performance is assessed. So, for example, a manager may give her employees a rating based on how far above or below average their performance is. She may calculate her employees' bonuses by figuring out the correct proportion of the average bonus each should receive. And probably the most obvious symptom of average thinking, she may spend most of her time trying to help her strugglers inch their performance up above average, while leaving her above average performers to their own devices. This kind of average thinking is very tempting. It seems so safe and so practical. By focusing on your strugglers, you are protecting yourself and the company from their inevitable mistakes. Nonetheless, great managers reject it. Here are a couple of reasons why. First, they don't use average performance as the barometer against which each person's performance is judged. They use excellence. From their perspective, average is irrelevant to excellence. Second, they know that the only people who are ever going to reach excellence are the employees who are already above average. These employees have already shown some natural ability to perform the role. These employees have talent. Counterintuitively, employees who are already performing above average have the greatest room for growth. Great managers also know that it is hard work helping a talented person hone his talents. If a manager is preoccupied with the burden of transforming strugglers into survivors by helping them squeak above average, he will have little time left for the truly difficult work of guiding the good toward great. Gene P's story illustrates both the irrelevance of average and the growth potential of talent. For data entry roles, the national performance average is 380,000 key punches per month, or 19,000 per day. Many companies use an average performance measure like this to determine how many data entry employees they need to hire. Upon hiring these data entry folk, a good manager should probably be able to raise his employees' performance higher than this national average. How much higher? Using this average as your measure, what should a good manager's goal be? 25% higher? 35% higher? 50% higher? 50% higher would put you over 500,000 key punches per month. In fact, the top performing data entry employees make a mockery of the national average. They outperform it almost tenfold. Gene P is one such employee. When her performance was first measured, she averaged 560,000 punches per month, already 50% above the national average. She was recognized for her performance. Then she and her manager set some individual goals that could help her improve and track her performance. 3 months later, she hit 1 million key punches. A couple of weeks after that milestone, Jean checked her total at the end of the day and saw that she had managed 112,000 key punches in one day. She approached her manager and said, "You know what? If I average over 110,000 for the whole month, then I'll hit the 2 million mark." They put a plan together, and 6 months later, she soared past 2 million. Jean became a model for the role. Her manager spent time watching her, asking her why she loved her work so much. "I'm real competitive. I love counting." And why she seemed to make fewer mistakes the more keys she punched. "I have more practice." He designed a talent profile to find more like her and a compensation plan to reward her excellence. Today, Jean's personal best is 3,526,000 key punches in a month, and the average of all the data entry employees working around her is over 1 million. The lessons from Jean's story are applicable to almost any role. Don't use average to estimate the limits of excellence. You will drastically underestimate what is possible. Focus on your best performers and keep pushing them toward the right edge of the bell curve. It is counterintuitive, but top performers like Gene P. have the most potential for growth. Breaking through the ceiling. Average thinking not only leads managers away from excellence and away from their top performers, there is one final and perhaps most damaging way in which it harms a manager's best efforts. Average thinking actively limits performance. Jeff H., a sales manager for a computer software company, describes this debilitating effect. I work for a company with one goal, 20% annual growth in revenue and profits. We have it drummed into us from day one that 20% growth is how we will judge our success as a company. We've hit it for 12 years straight, and Wall Street loves us. I can see why the company needs to shoot for that number every year. I can see why Wall Street likes that predictability. But as an individual manager of people, it's hard. Put yourself in my shoes. We've been the number one region for the last 4 years. Every year I get to the end of the third quarter and all my people have hit their 20% growth targets. They have a whole quarter to go, but they've already reached their target. You try motivating this group to give it all they've got for the final 3 months. To them, it makes much more sense to save all their sales for next year, so that come January, they've got themselves off to a rolling start. You can't blame them for slowing down. The quota system encourages it. Every year, I have to fight against the very system that was designed to help us all excel. I have to hunt for other ways to keep everybody fired up. How does he do it? Jeff happens to have an intense and conceptual style, so he resorts to writing thoughtful letters to all of his people, cajoling them to look inside themselves and deliver one last ounce of effort. Here's an example. October 29. People, with only 2 months remaining, it is imperative that you stay focused on your goals for this year. It has been a long, well-run race so far this year, and for many of you, you could just coast the rest of the year and still make quota. That decision is yours. I can't make that for you, and I will not pound or threaten for more. However, if we want, and you want, to be the best you are capable of being, and you want to develop your abilities to their maximum, that goal is a never-ending one. You must understand that success is achieved through a never-ending pursuit of improvement, personally, professionally, financially, and spiritually. Like it or not, that is what is involved, and that is the commitment you made to yourself when you accepted the challenge to be the best. Remember, stay focused. Never lose your commitment to your own standard of excellence. Push a little every day, and a lot over time. Sincerely, Jeff. P.S. You are the best the company has, and the best I have ever had the privilege of managing. Jeff is fortunate. With his sincere personal appeals and his mantra that each person should push a little every day and a lot over time, Jeff has managed to break through the restraints of the quota system. He has found a way to keep everyone focused on excellence. Despite the limits imposed by quotas, Jeff has now led his region to the company's top spot 4 years in a row. Other great managers with their unique talents and styles will devise their own routes to excellence. But despite this success, it is still a shame that they had to waste so much creativity maneuvering around performance evaluation schemes that unwittingly place a ceiling on performance. It is still a shame that they had to exert so much energy railing against average thinking. This energy and creativity would be much more valuable in the unfettered pursuit of excellence. If you face the same average thinking, you should rail against it just as energetically. Define excellence vividly, quantitatively. Paint a picture for your most talented employees of what excellence looks like. keep everyone pushing and pushing toward that right edge of the bell curve. It's fairer, it's more productive, and most of all, it's much more fun. How to manage around a weakness. How do great managers turn a harmful weakness into an irrelevant non-talent? Of course, none of this means that great managers ignore non-performance. They don't. Focus on strengths is not another name for the power of positive thinking. Bad things happen. Some people fail. Some people struggle. And even your star performers have their faults. Poor performance must be confronted head-on if it is not to degenerate into a dangerously unproductive situation. And it must be confronted quickly. As with all degenerative diseases, procrastination in the face of poor performance is a fool's remedy. The most straightforward causes of an employee's poor performance are the mechanical causes. Perhaps the company is not providing him with the tools or the information he needs. And the personal causes. Perhaps she is still grieving from a recent death in the family. As a manager, if you are confronted with poor performance, look first to these two causes. Both are relatively easy to identify. Both also happen to be rather difficult to solve. The former will almost certainly require some careful job redesign and better cooperation between individuals or departments. The latter will demand understanding and patience. But at least you will know what is causing the performance problems. However, many performance problems have subtler causes that are more difficult to identify. But fortunately, with the right mindset, their solutions are all within a manager's control. The great manager begins by asking two questions. First, is improved performance trainable? If the employee is struggling because he doesn't have the necessary skills or knowledge, then it almost certainly is trainable. Jan B., a manager in an advertising agency, gives us a simple example. One associate was supposed to turn all of my handwritten notes into killer presentations, but it wasn't happening. Her turnaround was slow, and the finished product wasn't that great. I sat her down and subjected her to one of my heart-to-hearts, during which she confessed that she had never learned PowerPoint properly. She was a brilliant art student, but no one had taught her the detailed mechanics of putting that brilliance onto a computer. Well, that's easy. I just set her up with some intensive PowerPoint training, and now she's a star. Lori T., a manager in a petrochemical company, describes a slightly more subtle approach to imparting knowledge. Jim was a very talented young man who always used to come in late. We talked about it, and he said that he was just terrible at organizing himself to arrive on time. Every morning something would happen to throw him off. He said I shouldn't worry because he always stayed late and completed his assignments. I told him that I was worried. I was worried about how others were perceiving him. I asked him what he imagined other people's perceptions of him were. He confessed that they probably associated his lateness with laziness, a lack of responsibility, and being a poor team player. "But that's not me," he said. "I know that's not you," I replied, "but they don't. I'm not saying that you must come in on time from now on. I am saying that you must manage your teammates' perceptions better. Otherwise, they won't trust you. You'll drag the team down, and I'll have to ask you to leave." Jim now comes in on time 95% of the time. I didn't change his behavior. What changed his behavior was his knowledge of how negatively others were perceiving him and his awareness that he didn't like that. These examples are probably familiar to you. You may have faced the salesperson who didn't know the product well enough, or the secretary who didn't know how to process expenses, or the recently hired business school graduate who hadn't yet learned how to prepare a report for the real business world. All of these cases of non-performance can be traced to the employee's lack of certain skills or knowledge, whether it's as simple as teaching someone a computer program or as delicate as helping someone gain a perspective on himself. All of these skills and knowledge can and should be trained. The second question great managers ask is this. Is the non-performance caused by the manager tripping the wrong trigger? Each employee is motivated differently. If the manager forgets this, if he's trying to motivate a non-competitive person with contests or a shy person with public praise, then the solution to the non-performance might well lie in the manager's hands. If he can find the right trigger and trip it, perhaps the employee's true talent will burst out. John F., a general insurance agent, needed a very public misstep to help him understand this. His most productive agent was Mark D. A repeat winner of the Agent of the Year award, Mark let it be known that he hated the banal plaques that accompanied the award. If he was going to be recognized, he said, he would prefer something other than another meaningless plaque to shove in a drawer along with the others. John listened patiently, but believed he knew better. All salespeople love plaques, he thought. At the awards banquet, John announced Mark as the winner yet again, ushered him up onto the stage, and proudly presented him with his plaque. Mark took one look at it, turned to the audience, made an obscene gesture, and stalked off the stage, vowing to leave the company. The banquet was a disaster. John spoke to some of Mark's colleagues to see if he could learn anything that would help recover the situation. Apparently, on car rides, in the hallways and over lunches, or whenever the conversation inched toward life outside the office, Mark would bring up his two daughters. He and his wife thought they could never have children, so these two little girls were a particularly precious gift. Mark would describe their exploits and their triumphs and the funny little things they would say to him. He was so proud of them. They were his life. As quickly as he could, John called Mark's wife and explained the situation. She had an idea. She took the two girls to a photographic studio and had a beautiful portrait taken of them and mounted in a frame. Mark's plaque was embossed on the frame. 2 weeks later, John held a luncheon. In front of all his agents and the guests of honor, Mark's wife and daughters, John unveiled the portrait and presented it to Mark. The same prima donna who had flipped off the crowd now started to cry. Mark's trigger was his two daughters. This would not have worked if Mark had felt that John didn't genuinely care about him. But fortunately, over the years, trust had developed between the two of them. The only aspect that had been missing from their relationship was a full understanding on John's part of what was truly important to Mark. Guided by the clues from Mark's colleagues, John filled that gap. From now on, he would respect and play to Mark's unique motivational trigger. All managers can learn from John's example. If an employee's performance goes awry, perhaps you have misread what motivates him. Perhaps if you tripped a different trigger, the employee's true talents would re-engage. Perhaps you are to blame for his poor performance. Before you do anything else, consider this possibility. However, if you can genuinely answer no to both of these initial questions, no, it's not a skills or knowledge issue, and no, it's not a trigger issue, then, by default, the non-performance is probably a talent issue. The person is struggling because she doesn't have the specific talents she needs to perform. In this case, training is not an option. Given the enduring nature of talent, it is highly unlikely that she will ever be able to acquire the necessary talent. She is who she is, and left to her own devices, she will always be hamstrung by areas where she lacks talent. This situation seems bleak, but it's actually rather commonplace. After all, no one's perfect. No one possesses all of the talents needed to excel in a particular role. Each of us is a couple of talent cards short of a full deck. The difference between a non-talent and a weakness. As you might expect, great managers take a welcomingly pragmatic view of our innate imperfection. They begin with an important distinction, a distinction between weaknesses and non-talents. A non-talent is a mental wasteland. It is a behavior that always seems to be a struggle. It is a thrill that is never felt. It is an insight recurrently missed. In isolation, non-talents are harmless. You might have a non-talent for remembering names, being empathetic, or thinking strategically. Who cares? You have many more non-talents than you have talents, but most of them are irrelevant. You should ignore them. However, a non-talent can mutate into a weakness. A non-talent becomes a weakness when you find yourself in a role where success depends on your excelling in an area that is a non-talent for you. If you are a server in a restaurant, your non-talent for remembering names becomes a weakness because regulars want you to recognize them. If you are a salesperson, your non-talent for empathy becomes a weakness because your prospects need to feel understood. If you are an executive, your non-talent for strategic thinking becomes a weakness because your company needs to know what traps or opportunities lie hidden over the horizon. You would be wise not to ignore your weaknesses. Great managers don't. As soon as they realize that a weakness is causing the poor performance, they switch their approach. They know that there are only three possible routes to helping someone succeed. Devise a support system, find a complementary partner, or find an alternative role. Great managers quickly bear down, weigh these options, and choose the best route. Devise a support system. Approximately 147 million Americans are incapable of seeing with 20/20 vision. 700 years ago, anyone cursed with farsightedness, nearsightedness, or astigmatism would have been seriously handicapped. But as the science of optics developed, it became possible to grind lenses that could correct for these conditions. These lenses were then mounted in frames to make spectacles or glasses. And with this one invention, the weakness of imperfect vision was reduced to an irrelevant non-talent. Millions of Americans still suffer from imperfect vision, but armed with a support system of glasses or contact lenses, nobody cares. The speediest cure for a debilitating weakness is a support system. If one employee finds it difficult to remember names, buy him a Rolodex. If another is an appalling speller, make sure she always runs spell check before she prints. Mandy M., the manager of the design department, describes one effective consultant who undermined her own credibility by always wearing trendy coveralls. Mandy took her shopping and made sure she had at least one presentable business suit that she could wear in front of clients. Jeff B., the sales manager for the computer software company, saw one of his salespeople's performance slipping because of pressures at home. The salesperson's wife was upset that he was receiving so many business calls on their personal line. Jeff bought him a second line and told him to designate one room in his house as an office, to define set hours when the office door would be shut, and to turn off the ringer during those hours. Marie S., a general insurance agent, had to contend with a superbly productive agent who not only wielded a huge ego, but who also spread negativity around him every time he was back in the office. Her solution? Cut a new door in his office wall that opened directly onto the elevator hallway, and mount a plaque over the door announcing the agent's name in classic gold lettering. With one stroke, she not only fulfilled his ego needs, she also diverted him directly into his office and away from his negative wanderings. This solution may seem a little extreme, but whether they are cutting holes in walls or simply buying Rolodexes, these managers are all doing the same thing. They are managing around the employee's weakness so they can spend time focusing on his strengths. As with all focus on strength strategies, devising a support system is more productive and more fun than trying to fix the weakness. Occasionally, a support system can serve a different purpose. A large restaurant chain had made a commitment to hiring a certain number of intellectually disabled employees, believing that they could find these individuals some simple yet meaningful work. Their altruism occasionally proved rather difficult to execute in the real world. The president describes one individual, Janice, who was employed to unpack chicken, place each piece carefully in the fryer, and then lift them all out once the timer had sounded. Janice was fully capable of understanding the responsibilities of the role and performed its mechanics perfectly. But she couldn't count, and the fryer could only hold 6 pieces of chicken. More often than not, Janice would overfill the fryer, leaving each piece of chicken dangerously undercooked. The company could have easily given up on Janice because of her inability to count, but they chose not to. Instead, they devised a simple support system to manage around her weakness. They asked their chicken supplier to send the chicken in packages of 6. This way, Janice wouldn't have to count. She could just empty each packet into the fryer, and the chicken would be cooked to perfection every time. The supplier refused the request. "It would be too much work on our end," they complained. So the company fired the supplier and engaged another that was willing to ship chicken in packets of 6. Now nobody cares that Janice can't count. Her weakness is irrelevant. It is now a non-talent. Find a complementary partner. Each year, buoyed by the hope that leaders are made, not born, tens of thousands of budding executives traipse off to leadership development courses. There they discover the many different traits and competencies that constitute the model leader. They receive feedback from their peers and direct reports, feedback that reveals their unique leadership profile. Finally, after all the learning and reflection is complete, the hard work begins. Each willing participant is asked to craft a plan to fill in those valleys so that he can reshape himself into the model leader, smooth and well-rounded. That last step, according to great managers, is an unfortunate mistake. They agree that leaders should know all the roles that they need to play. They agree that leaders should look in the mirror and learn how they come across to peers and direct reports. But that last step, crafting a plan to become more well-rounded, is, in their view, woefully naive. If the individual comes to the training class a poor public speaker, he will leave a poor public speaker. If he is non-confrontational, he will always be tempted to shy away from battle. If he is impractical, he will forever struggle with bringing his ideas down to land. A training class might help him learn why certain talents are important and how they work, but no matter how earnest he is, a training class will not help him acquire them. This isn't a depressing revelation. The most renowned leaders in the history of corporate America have always known it. As they struggled to carve out their success, the last thing on their mind was to become well-rounded. They may have been aware of their own shortcomings, but none of them worked at turning these shortcomings into strengths. They knew what a hopeless waste of time that would be. So they did something else instead. They looked for a partner. Walt Disney didn't have to look far to find his brother Roy. Through the good graces of their Stanford professor, William Hewitt found David Packard. Bill Gates and Paul Allen were fortunate enough to bump into each other in their high school computer club. None of these extraordinarily successful leaders was well-rounded. They may have had a broad knowledge of their respective businesses, but in terms of talent, each one was sharp in one or two key areas and blunt in many others. Each partnership was effective precisely because where one partner was blunt, the other was sharp. The partnerships were well-rounded, not the individuals. Even leaders who appeared to stand alone usually balanced their act with a complementary partner. At Disney, the massively intelligent, insatiably competitive Michael Eisner benefited from the more practical, down-to-earth Frank Wells. And at Electronic Data Systems, behind the impetuous, inspirational Ross Perot, you would have found the wise guiding hand of the president, Mitch Hart. The lesson from these leaders is quite clear. You succeed by finding ways to capitalize on who you are, not by trying to fix who you aren't. If you are blunt in one or two important areas, try to find a partner whose peaks match your valleys. Balanced by this partner, you are then free to hone your talents to a sharper point. This lesson is applicable across virtually all roles and professions. Since few people are a perfect fit for their role, the great manager will always be looking for ways to match up one person's valleys with another person's peaks. Jan B. had a highly creative researcher, Diane, who seemed to be congenitally incapable of turning in her expense reports on time. Instead of wasting time berating her for her constant failure, Jan simply told her, "Every time you get back from a trip, drop your expenses into an envelope and hand them to Larry. He'll figure them out." Larry isn't an assistant. He's a researcher like Diane. But he's the most organized person on the small team, so he gets to handle Diane's expenses. It may be unconventional. It certainly requires trust and respect between Larry and Diane. But in Jan's mind, it is the only way to capitalize on Larry's talent and simultaneously release Diane from her weakness. Jeff B., the software sales manager, is not only a sincere, passionate, and conceptual man, he is also, it turns out, a rotten planner. "I've never been good at tactics," he confesses. "I am excellent at ground zero, building trust face to face. And I am excellent at 20,000 feet, finding patterns, playing out scenarios, but I'm terrible in between. That's where Tony's so good. When we look at a situation, he asks different questions than me. I'll ask, 'What if?' or 'Why not?' He'll ask, 'How many?' or 'When?' or 'Prove it.' If I went to the board with my half-baked ideas, I'd get shot down every time. But with the two of us working on the same idea, our case ends up looking so convincing, they haven't been able to turn us down once. As I say to Tony, individually we're not much, but together we have a brain." When you interview great managers, you are bombarded with examples like these. After a while, the partnerships they describe begin to seem almost archetypal. Of course the creative but impractical thinker wound up partnered with the streetwise business-savvy operator. Of course the administratively impaired salesperson teamed up with the no-detail-too-small office manager. And of course the cocky, needy high flyer found a mentor in the tough-loving veteran. It was inevitable. These things just happen. But they don't. The partnerships great managers describe are not archetypes. There is nothing inevitable about them at all. Each partnership is, in fact, an anomaly, a surprisingly rare example of one manager bucking the system and figuring out how to make the most of uniquely imperfect people. Great managers talk about these partnerships so nonchalantly, it is easy to forget just how difficult they are to forge in the real world. How companies prevent partnerships. A healthy partnership is based on one crucial understanding. Neither partner is perfect. If potential partners are afraid to admit their imperfections, are trying diligently to correct them, or are reluctant to ask for help, neither will be on the lookout for a productive partnership. They will be nervous about confessing to too many faults and suspicious of anyone who offers. Strangely, most companies actively encourage this kind of behavior. Job descriptions for even the simplest roles run 2 or 3 pages, presumably in hopes of capturing every minute task that the perfect incumbent should be able to perform. Training classes and development plans target those few behaviors where you consistently struggle. Everyone talks of the need to broaden your skill set. Perhaps the most pervasive example of partnership prevention, however, can be found in the conventional wisdom on teams and teamwork. Conventional wisdom's most frequently quoted line on teams is, "There is no I in team." The point here seems to be that teams are built on collaboration and mutual support. The whole is, apparently, more important than its individual parts. On the surface, this appears to be eminently right-minded. Taking these sentiments as their starting point, many companies have dedicated themselves to creating self-managed teams. Here, companies encourage team members to rotate into different roles on the team. The more roles they learn, the more they are paid. And everyone is supposed to focus on the team's goals and performance, not his own. However, conventional wisdom's view of teamwork is dangerously misleading. Great managers do not believe that a productive team has camaraderie as its cornerstone, and team members who can play all roles equally well. On the contrary, they define a productive team as one in which each person knows which role he plays best and is cast in that role most of the time. The founding principle here is that excellent teams are built around individual excellence. Therefore, the manager's first responsibility is to make sure each person is positioned in the right role. Her second responsibility is to balance the strengths and weaknesses of each individual so that they complement one another. Then, and only then, should she turn her attention to broader issues like camaraderie or team spirit. One team member might occasionally have to step out of his role to support another, but this kind of pinch hitting should be a rarity on great teams, not their very essence. Jim Kay, a full bird colonel in the Army, an organization that might be forgiven for emphasizing flexibility and camaraderie over individual excellence, gives this description of team building. "When I first assemble the platoon, I ask each person to tell me what activities he is mostly drawn to. One will say sharpshooting, one will say radio, one will say explosives, and so on. I'll go around the whole group taking notes. Then when I build each squad, I try to assign each person to the role he said he was drawn to. Obviously, you won't get a perfect match, and obviously every soldier will be required to learn every role on the platoon. We might lose a man in battle and every soldier must be able to step in. But you've got to start by assigning the right duties to the right soldier. If you get that wrong, your platoon will falter in combat." Whereas conventional wisdom views individual specialization as the antithesis of teamwork, great managers see it as the founding principle. If individual positioning is so important, then at the heart of a great team, there must be an I. There must be lots of strong, distinct I's. There must be individuals who know themselves well enough to pick the right roles, and to feel comfortable in them most of the time. If one individual joins the team with little understanding of his own strengths and weaknesses, then he will drag the entire team down with his poor performance and his vague yearnings to switch roles. Self-aware individuals, strong eyes, are the building blocks of great teams. Find an alternative role. There are some people for whom nothing works. You trip every trigger imaginable. You train, you find partners, you buy Rolodexes, teach spell check, and cut through office walls. But nothing works. Faced with this situation, you have little choice. You have to find this employee an alternative role. You have to move him out. Sometimes the only way to cure a bad relationship is to get out of it. Similarly, sometimes the only way to cure poor performance is to get the performer out of that role. How do you know if you are at that point? You will never know for sure, but the best managers offer this advice. You will have to manage around the weaknesses of each and every employee. But if, with one particular employee, you find yourself spending most of your time managing around weaknesses, then know that you have made a casting error. At this point, it is time to fix the casting error and to stop trying to fix the person. Chapter 6, The Fourth Key, Find the Right Fit. The Blind, Breathless Climb. One rung doesn't necessarily lead to another. Create heroes in every role. Three stories and a new career. The Art of Tough Love. The Blind, Breathless Climb. What's wrong with the old career path? Sooner or later, every manager is asked the question, where do I go from here? The employee wants to grow. He wants to earn more money and to gain more prestige. He is bored, underutilized, and/or deserves more responsibility. Whatever his reasons, the employee wants to move up and wants you to help. What should you tell him? Should you help him get promoted? Should you tell him to talk to human resources? Should you say that all you can do is put in a good word for him? What is the right answer? There is no right answer. Any one of these answers might be the right one, depending on the situation. However, there is a right way to approach this question. Namely, help each person find the right fit. Help each person find a role that asks him to do more and more of what he is naturally wired to do. Help each person find a role where her unique combination of strengths, her skills, knowledge, and talents match the distinct demands of the role. For one employee, this might mean promotion to a supervisor role. For another employee, this might mean termination. For another, it might mean encouraging him to grow within his current role. For yet another, it might mean moving her back into her previous role. These are very different answers, some of which might be decidedly unpopular with the employee. Nonetheless, no matter how bitter the pill, great managers stick to their goal. Regardless of what employees want, the manager's responsibility is to steer employees toward roles where they have the greatest chance of success. On paper, this sounds straightforward, but as you can imagine, it proves to be a great deal more challenging in the real world. This is primarily because, in the real world, conventional wisdom persuades most of us that the right answer to the question, where do I go from here, is up. Careers, conventional wisdom advises, should follow a prescribed path. You begin in a lowly individual contributor role. You gain some expertise and so are promoted to a slightly more stretching, slightly less menial individual contributor role. Next, you are promoted to supervise other individual contributors. Then, blessed with good performance, good fortune, and good contacts, you climb up and up until you can barely remember what the individual contributors do at all. In his 1969 book, The Peter Principle, Lawrence Peter warned that if we followed this path without question, we would wind up promoting each person to his level of incompetence. It was true then, it is true now. Unfortunately, in the intervening years, we haven't succeeded in changing very much. We still think that the most creative way to reward excellence in a role is to promote the person out of it. We still tie pay, perks, and titles to a rung on the ladder. The higher the rung, the greater the pay, the better the perks, and the grander the title. Every signal we send tells the employee to look onward and upward. Don't stay in your current role for too long, we advise. It looks bad on the resume. Keep pressing, pushing, stretching to take that next step. It's the only way to get ahead. It's the only way to get respect. These signals, although well-intended, place every employee in an extremely precarious position. To earn respect, he knows he must climb. And as he takes each step, he sees that the company is burning the rungs behind him. He cannot retrace his steps, not without being tarred with the failure brush. So he continues his blind, breathless climb to the top, and sooner or later, he overreaches. Sooner or later, he steps into the wrong role. And there, he is trapped. Unwilling to go back, unable to climb up, he clings to his rung until finally the company pushes him off. A rung too far. Mark C. was pushed. He was pushed off, down, and out. Standing on Pennsylvania Avenue, Mark gazed up at the White House and tried to piece together what had happened. 2 years earlier, he had been living out of his suitcase as the leading foreign correspondent for a European television station. 1 week he would find himself in Zaire covering the fall of a dictator, and the next week he would turn up in Chechnya to record the retreat of rebel insurgents. Wherever he went, everyone acknowledged Mark as the master. Somehow, he was able to find the center of all the anger and confusion and extract some meaning from the madness. When armies shelled marketplaces or snipers picked off civilians on their walk to work, Mark would be at the scene explaining what happened, why it happened, and what it all meant. To his viewers, he was a calming, authoritative presence. They trusted him. So no one was surprised when he was posted to Jerusalem. On the foreign correspondent's ladder, Washington is the top rung. It has the most prestige, the most money, and importantly, the most airtime. It is the posting everyone wants. But if Washington is number one, then Jerusalem runs a close second. More interesting than the European Parliament in Brussels, and more important than post-Cold War Moscow, Jerusalem is one of the few places where local clashes have such global significance. It is a foreign correspondent's dream. In Jerusalem, Mark refined his talents. Israel is a small country, and Mark was able to report live from the scene, no matter where the action erupted. Israeli settlers protesting the latest peace accords? Mark would be in their midst, marching with them, shouting his report over the noise of the crowd. Palestinian youths hurling paving stones at Israeli troops? Mark would be filmed in one of the narrow side streets, explaining the reasons for their anger simply and clearly. In the overheated climate of the Middle East, Mark became the cool voice of reason. A year later, his European managers offered him the top rung. They offered him the money, the prestige, and the exposure of Washington. Mark loved what he was doing, but there was no way he was going to turn this down. It was the plum job of all reporting assignments. He willingly unpacked his suitcases for the last time and settled in to become the newest, best Washington bureau chief. And very quickly, things started to fall apart. Outside of the occasional titillating scandal, not much happens in Washington, at least not during Mark's tenure. Yes, there might be a presidential veto 1 week and a filibuster the next, but back in Europe, few understand these events and even fewer care. Most of the action is dry and repetitious, important but uninteresting. The Washington bureau chief's role is to take the tedious business of politics and inject it with heroes and villains, daring triumphs and crushing defeats. His job is to spice things up. And Mark couldn't do it. He was brilliant at giving real-life drama a political context, but he was terrible at giving politics the sheen of real-life drama. Mark was sure-footed in the aftermath of a mortar attack, but in a town where a State of the Union address was big news, he didn't know what to do. The stories went begging. His reporting became bland. He was lost. Back in Europe, his audience turned away. His European managers couldn't put their finger on it, but they noticed the difference. They stuck with him for a while. He deserved that much. And then they pulled the plug. In 6 months, the hero of Jerusalem had shriveled into the embarrassment in Washington. He was removed. Mark's role might seem quite exotic, But his fate is commonplace. In his desire to grow and to please his managers, he kept climbing the ladder until one day he climbed one rung too far. Sadly, this happens all the time. To gain money, title, and respect, teachers must become administrators. Managers must reach for leadership. Nurses must aspire to be nurse supervisors. Craftsmen must yearn to be managers of other craftsmen. And reporters must yearn to be bureau chiefs. In most companies, Mark's fate awaits us all. Lawrence Peter was right. Most employees are promoted to their level of incompetence. It's inevitable. It's built into the system. It doesn't have to be this way. This system is flawed, for it is built on three false assumptions. The first fallacy is that each rung on the ladder represents a slightly more complex version of the previous rung. Consequently, if a person excelled on one rung on the ladder, it is a sure sign that with just a little more training, he will be able to repeat his success on the rung above. The best managers reject this. They know that one rung doesn't necessarily lead to another. Second, the conventional career path is condemned to create conflict. By limiting prestige to those few rungs high up on the ladder, it tempts every employee, even the most self-aware, to try to clamber onto the next rung. Each rung is a competition, and since there are fewer rungs than there are employees, each competition generates many more losers than winners. Great managers have a better idea. Why not resolve the conflict by making prestige more available? Why not carve out alternative career paths by conveying meaningful prestige on every role performed at excellence? Why not create heroes in every role? The third and most devastating flaw in the system is its assumption that varied experiences make the employee more attractive. This assumption focuses the employee on hunting for marketable skills and experiences. With these skills and experiences proudly displayed on his resume, the employee then meekly waits, or aggressively lobbies, to be chosen for the next rung. In this scenario, the employee is the supplicant. The manager is the gatekeeper, pushing back the hordes and selecting the attractive ones. The ones with the most skills and the best experiences for advancement. Great managers know that this whole scenario is awry. In their view, the hunt for marketable skills and experiences should not be the force driving the employee's career. They envision a different driving force. They have a new career in mind. One rung doesn't necessarily lead to another. Why do we keep promoting people to their level of incompetence? Why do we continue to assume that a person's success on one rung will have any relevance to his or her likelihood to succeed on the rung above? More than likely, we have been confused about what is trainable and what is not. We have made no distinction among skills, knowledge, and talents. And if this clumsy language has made it easier for us to say, if John has shown himself to be a good salesperson, then I'm sure we can just train him to be a good manager. Or, since Jan has proven herself a solid manager, I am confident that we can teach her the strategic thinking and the vision needed to be a great leader. As noted earlier, we now know that excellence in every role requires distinct talents. And that these talents, unlike skills and knowledge, are extraordinarily difficult to train. Armed with this knowledge, we can dismantle some long-standing career paths. We know that the talents needed to sell and the talents needed to manage, while not mutually exclusive, are different. If you excel at one, it does not tell us very much about whether you will excel at the other. We can say the same about the talents needed to manage compared with the talents needed to lead. In fact, we can say the same about all roles, even roles that, at first glance, seem to be very similar. Consider, for example, the conventional information technology career path. If you work in information technology, you tend to begin your career as a computer programmer, writing code, and then progress to a systems analyst role, designing integrated systems. Programmer to systems analyst. These are the first two rungs on the conventional IT career path. And given their superficial similarity, this would seem to be a sensible way to structure things. In fact, these two roles are quite different. Great programmers possess a thinking talent called problem solving. The best programmers want to be given all the pieces of the puzzle. Once they are armed with all the pieces, their particular talent is the ability to rearrange the pieces so that they all fit together perfectly. In their personal life, this talent often draws them to crossword puzzles or brain teasers, like the ones in Chapter 3. In their professional life, this talent enables them to write thousands of lines of computer code and arrange them in the most effective and efficient order. While this talent is nice for a systems analyst to possess, it is not particularly relevant to success on the job. By contrast, the most important thinking talent for systems analysts is called formulation. They revel in situations where they are faced with incomplete data. Lacking some of the most important facts, they can then do what they love, play out alternative scenarios, hypothesize, and test their theories. On the job, this talent enables them to construct highly intricate systems and then test these systems for bugs. If one system has a glitch, then they play out different scenarios, narrowing the range of possible solutions until they have identified exactly what they need to change and where and why. The talents of problem solving and formulation are not mutually exclusive. It is entirely possible for an employee to possess both. But if you are blessed with a talent for problem solving, it does not necessarily mean that you are similarly blessed with a talent for formulation. To promote programmers to systems analysts simply because the conventional career path dictates that you should is to take a blind roll of the dice. You are just as likely to wind up with a team of misfits as you are a team of talented systems analysts. Before you promote someone, look closely at the talents needed to excel in the role, the striving, thinking, and relating talents necessary for success. After scrutinizing the person and the role, you may still choose promotion. And since each person is highly complex, you may still end up promoting your employee into a position where he struggles. No manager finds the perfect fit every time, but at least you will have taken the time to weigh the fit between the demands of the role and the talent of the person. If Mark's managers had bothered to think this through, perhaps they would have seen the poor fit between the Washington job, which required a reporter who loved to spice things up, and Mark, whose dominant talent was an ability to calm things down. Create heroes in every role. How to solve the shortage of respect. Even if you thoughtfully examine the match between the employee and the role, you've still got a problem. No matter what conclusion you come to, the employee will invariably want to move up. The employee will want to be promoted. Every signal the company sends tells him that higher is better. A larger salary, a more impressive title, more generous stock options, a roomier office with a couch and a coffee table. All this and more awaits the lucky employee on the next rung on the ladder. No wonder he wants to move up. These blazing neon lights are a damaging distraction. They not only tempt employees to jump from excellence on one rung to mediocrity on another, they also create a bottleneck, legions of employees all trying to scramble onto increasingly fewer rungs. Conflict and disappointment are inevitable. There has to be a way to redirect employees' driving ambition and to channel it more productively. There is. Create heroes in every